Welcome to Building the Future, Freedom, Prosperity, and Foreign Policy, a podcast series focused on updating the United States soft power playbook to meet the hopes and aspirations of developing countries because it's in America's interest to do so. I'm Dan Rundy, Senior Vice President at CSIS. There are a lot of global challenges out there, so let's get started. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Building the Future with Dan Rundy. Today, I'm joined by my friend Dan Negrea. He's the Senior Director of the Freedom and Prosperity Center at the Atlantic Council, and Matt Kronig, who's also another friend of mine, the Director of Studies, the Vice President and Senior Director of the Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security at the Atlantic Council. Dan and Matt are the co-authors of a new book slated for release on March 19th titled We Win, They Lose, Republican Foreign Policy and the New Cold War. Dan and Matt are recognized authorities on the subject, and their qualifications speak for themselves. Dan served as the U.S. Department of State Special Representative for Commercial and Business Affairs between 2019 and 2021, and he was also a member of the Secretary of State's Policy Planning Staff between 2018 and 2019, where he was responsible for the office's economic portfolio. Matt formerly served in the Department of Defense and in the intelligence community during the Bush, Obama, and Trump administrations. He's currently a tenured professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. And in 2022, he was appointed as a commissioner on the bipartisan Congressional Commission on the Strategic Posture of the United States. I'm podcasting Dan and Matt today to discuss their important new book, which tackles one of the most urgent strategic issues of our time, which is how the United States can leverage a conservative foreign policy to defend the free world against the rise of China and its new axis of authoritarian actors. I think this book is important because I think there's a series of misinformed views out there that the Republican Party or conservatives are in essence withdrawing from the world or have a neo-isolationist stance. This book disputes that position. And I think that's why this book is so important. And I've read the book. I've enjoyed it very much. And again, I was told by Frank Luntz, you have to repeat titles of a book seven times. So I'm going to repeat the title again. This is called We Win, They Lose, Republican Foreign Policy and the New Cold War. So Dan and Matt, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Dan. Honored.
Delighted to be here. Thank you, Dan.
So, Matt, let me start with you. Why did you write this book?
Well, again, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for the kind words on the book. And I'd say there are two reasons. One, we are in an extraordinarily dangerous time in international security. We have the largest war in Europe since World War II, major war in the Middle East, increasing Chinese threats against Taiwan. And so the United States needs a serious national security strategy. Dan and I are Republicans, a good chance there could be a Republican president within the year. And we wrote this in a way as a first draft of a national security strategy that a Republican administration could pick up as a guide to its foreign policy. But then second, as we were doing the research, we came to an idea, and a central argument of the book is this idea of a Trump-Reagan fusion for uniting the party and governing and winning the new Cold War. And I think there's something of a perception that the Republican Party is deeply divided. And Dan and I argue in this book that actually there is a consensus lurking just beneath the surface that we think can unite the party and help it to govern.
Okay. So Dan Negrea, in your title, the subtitle is A New Cold War. Why are we in a second Cold War and how is it different from the first one? All three of us, Matt and Dan Rundy, all remember the first Cold War. Why are we in a second Cold War and how's it different, Dan Negrea?
Dan Rundy, thank you very much for having us on your podcast. I've had the pleasure of being with you before and actually with Matt in our work on the Freedom and Prosperity Indexes that we produce at the Atlantic Council. Also, Dan Rundy, thank you very, very much for your guidance in thinking about this book. You're one of the people we are thanking in our introduction, people who gave us advice when conceptualizing what we have here. Matt and I considered it very important to make clear that we are in a new Cold War, to convey the seriousness of the moment and the seriousness of the challenge. And connected with the concept of the Second Cold War and the New Cold War is the concept of the new axis of evil, which again has its intellectual lineage to what W. Bush had with the axis of evil in his time, with Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, and in the First World War. The axes of evil that we have now are the PRC, People's Republic of China, Russia, Islamic Republic of Iran, and North Korea. Unlike the first Cold War, they are not all communists. Two of them are, but the others are also authoritarian. All these countries have something in common. Their strong opposition, strong, active, determined, continuous opposition to the free world with its concept of rule of law internally for people and rule of law in international relations, where a big country cannot invade a small neighbor to take away its territory. A lot is being made of how this Cold War is different from the previous Cold War, and therefore it may not be a Cold War at all. We think that what is more important is what is common between this Cold War and the previous one, which is the opposition between authoritarian, revisionist, aggressive countries and the free world.
So, okay, Matt, in a Cold War centered primarily on strategic competition with China, how should we think about Russia?
Well, Russia is a major threat on its own. We're seeing it invade several of its neighbor countries, including major war in Ukraine right now. It is aiming to restore the Russian Empire. But it's also a problem because it's aligned with China, and China is the greatest threat facing the United States and its allies. And the United States needs a serious strategy for beating China. And China and Russia are aligned. And so if we're going to defeat China, we also have to deal with the challenges posed by their allies, Russia, Iran, and North Korea.
Dan, should we continue to provide aid to Ukraine? We're having this conversation as there's an ongoing debate. I am in favor of aid to Ukraine. I think we should send them all the weapons. And to quote Richard Nixon, we should send everything that can fly to help Ukraine. But I'd be curious, what do you think about that? Because I think there's a narrative that says Republicans are not supportive of aid to Ukraine. And some of the folks that have resisted support, not all the folks, there's folks in the far left who wrote a letter in 2022 saying we should like hug it out. And, you know, then they retracted the letter. I think you know what I'm talking about. But there's a narrative out there in the media that the Republicans are against aid to Ukraine. I don't agree with that. But what do you think? Should we continue to provide aid to Ukraine, Dan?
So Matt and I write in the book that it is in the interest of the American people that Putin is defeated in Ukraine. There is absolutely no doubt that Putin's Russia, were it to occupy Ukraine, will have access to the vast population of Ukraine, another 40 million over the 140 that Russia had, would have access to the industrial capacity of Ukraine and its strategic position. This is not in the interest of the United States because Russia would be more powerful, a more powerful threat against Europe. And also China will have a more powerful, who doesn't have many allies of consequence, would have a more powerful ally. And also Xi Jinping would be emboldened in his aggressive designs on neighbors, Taiwan and others, by a success by Putin in Ukraine. So we argued about all this in the book, and therefore we should aid Ukraine. Now, however, what Matt and I are also saying, he and I authored an article about this. President Biden is not serving well the cause of aid to Ukraine by his lack of strategic clarity as to what the policy of the United States is with this very substantial aid. President Biden said, we'll be next to the Ukrainian, by the side of the Ukrainian people until the end. Until the end of what? What does this end look like? What is the goal? Also, the unwillingness of the Biden administration to solve the border crisis to the satisfaction of the Republicans in Congress, such that the Republicans in Congress feel able to support aid for the Ukraine, is also a problem. So we believe, Matt and I believe, that the solution to the Ukrainian crisis depends on continued American support, but it needs to have the right kind of U.S. presidential leadership, which right now we do not have.
Matt, how should we think about China? And I mean, we talk about we win, they lose as a title of the book. And you talk a little bit about in the intro explaining why you use the term we win, they lose, which I like very much. But how should we think about our relationship with China, and what does the end state of our relationship with China look like?
Well, first, how we should think about China. I do think that China poses the greatest threat to U.S. national security in the history of the country. And China is a much more capable adversary than the Soviet Union ever was. And it's a comprehensive threat. It's an economic threat, a technological threat, a threat when it comes to governance and human rights, and also a military threat. So this is a serious challenge. And we argue that the goal in this new Cold War, like Ronald Reagan said about the first Cold War, is the title of the book, We Win, They Lose. But what does that mean? What we say is that the goal should be to get to a place where China no longer has the capacity or the will to threaten U.S. core interests. And there are a number of different ways that that could come about. Or as Secretary Pompeo put it in his foreword to our book, we're aiming for the capitulation or the incapacitation of China.
I mean, can you imagine a scenario where China is someday a democracy?
Yes, and I think that is one way that this competition could end, that if China becomes, as the Chinese Communist Party falls, a different government comes to power that does respect human rights, respects international law, that would be a good outcome. But I think that's also unlikely, certainly in the short and medium term. And so Dan and I identify a number of other ways that we could win this competition. One is the incapacitation, that working with our allies, we outcompete China, and China just no longer has the capability to pose a serious threat. And that could be from the collapsing of the regime. It could be from the breaking up of the country, but also could be from the capitulation, that over time, competing for a generation or two, Chinese leaders look back and say, you know what, this didn't work. Competing with the United States and its allies is too difficult. It's too hard. We need to try a different approach. And I think that would be victory as well, even if that future government still calls itself the CCP. If it chooses not to challenge U.S. fundamental interests, that would be a success.
Dan, you have a chapter about allies and institutions. I want to talk about allies and burden sharing. It strikes me that one of the things, if one was to take a benign interpretation of many of the policies of the first Trump administration, one could argue that what it was an attempt to reset the terms of debate about burden sharing across a number of different dimensions of national security and foreign policy. I think this should be taken seriously. So I'd be curious about, if I say to you, allies and burden sharing, how does your book treat that? And how should we think about if there was another Republican president next year, how will they think about allies and burden sharing?
So Dan, we argue, Matt and I argue in the book, that the system of alliances and the large number of allies and partners that the United States has, in contrast, by the way, with the rather small number of countries in the new axis of evil, that this alliance system is a major strategic asset of the United States. We introduced the term the free world, which is a revival of a term from the first Cold War, and we show how, in terms of GDP, the free world is orders of magnitude larger than the axis of evil. What is also important is that the allies actually carry their weight. And this is not a new concept that was introduced by the Trump administration. President Eisenhower complained that the European allies are not carrying their weight and that Uncle Sam is becoming Uncle Sucker. So it is important that allies contribute militarily. NATO, for example, agreed in Wales after the first invasion of Ukraine in 2014 that they will contribute 2% of their GDP for defense. They are not. It's a fact that most European NATO members are below 2% and some even, shockingly, a few even under 1% and many under 1.5%. On the average, it's about 1.5%. But it is not just militarily that they need to carry their weight. There was a dangerous dependency on energy imports from Russia by European countries and a dangerous dependence on exports to China. So burden sharing and the lack of enthusiasm in countering China economically. So allies need to recognize that we are again in a Cold War. And I think they are starting to recognize that. And that this requires consequential moves, both in terms of their carrying a greater burden militarily and economically in countering the new axis of evil.
Matt, here's a question for you. Should the U.S. be prepared to attack targets inside Iran?
I think the short answer is yes. And as we're recording this podcast, we have instability in the Middle East. It's being backed by Iran. Iran trains and equips and funds Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, Shia militias in Iraq and Syria. They're attacking international shipping, have conducted over 100 attacks on U.S. bases in the region. Three Americans have just died. And the Biden administration, being excessively cautious, in my view, is only striking back at the proxies, not hitting back directly against Iran. And I think that in order to deter Iran, it's pretty simple. We have to convince Iran that the cost of attacking the United States and its allies outweigh the benefits. So we need to impose a big enough cost that Iran decides to back off. And we talk in the book about the successful models of Trump and Reagan. And Trump and Reagan understood this. When the Iranians were attacking international shipping during the Iran-Iraq war, Reagan sunk much of the Iranian Navy. And when the Iranians backed an attack that killed a U.S. military contractor in the Trump administration, Trump killed General Soleimani, the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. In both cases, Iran backed off. The last thing they want is a war with the world's largest superpower. And I think that's how the United States should continue to handle Iran today.
Dan, in this context of the Second Cold War, how should we think about democracy and human rights abroad? I've had a number of conversations with some conservatives and Republicans where they believe that the term human rights has been hijacked by the progressive left. And I can understand why they could see that. The Reagan administration was great on many issues on democracy and human rights in many ways and made the Soviet Union uncomfortable and supported things like the Solidarity Movement in the 1980s in Poland. So I do think Republicans, you know, also Republicans have stood up for religious freedom in places. I think the Trump administration stood up for Uyghurs and religious minorities and had concerns about Christians in the Middle East. So I've said, you know, or stood up for Venezuelan dissidents against the Maduro regime. So what would a Republican administration in 2025 look like if I said democracy and human rights?
So in our book, Matt and I talk about the hierarchy of interests that foreign policy should have to serve the interests of the American people. And we start with vital interests, make sure that nobody threatens the people of the United States, Americans abroad. We continue with important interests. And then we also have other interests. Promoting democracy abroad is an interest of the United States. Ideally, we would like all countries around the world to be democracies because it would be in the national security interest of the American people. Democracies tend not to go to war with other democracies. Democracies trade fairly with other democracies. So we do have an interest in that. But the most important interest, the vital interest, is national security. And what we should not do in the matter of democracy and human rights is give it an inappropriate role in this hierarchy. So, for example, Matt and I wrote an article and also mentioned in the book that we take exception to how the Biden administration defines the moment in time in which we are, that it is a contest between autocracy and democracy. We think that the contest is between aggressive revisionist countries that are not afraid to use military power against their neighbors and others and create a dangerous environment for people everywhere, and especially for the American people, which is our primary interest, and not authoritarians in general. So to take the example of Saudi Arabia, it is not a democracy, but it's an important partner of the United States. And they should be viewed as such in, for example, countering Iran. Similarly, Vietnam, it's a communist country, but it is on the side of the United States checking another communist country that is against the United States, which is China. So we do believe that democracy and human rights are important, and we advocate that, but it shouldn't be the central or most important objective of our foreign policy.
Okay. Matt, how should we think about foreign assistance in all this? I think in the Trump administration, there was a lot of skepticism towards foreign assistance and attempts to make significant cuts to it. How do you all treat that in your book, given that you all are positing we're in a second Cold War?
Well, thanks, Dan. And it reminds me, I never really gave the overview of the book because we cover a lot of ground, but we don't do everything. So we started talking about what is a conservative foreign policy versus a progressive foreign policy. We go talk about major principles of a conservative foreign policy, peace through strength, free and fair trade, American exceptionalism. And then we go through both the history of how Reagan and Trump and other presidents dealt with issues, but then also what we should do today when it comes to important issues like China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, alliances, border, climate, and others. But we don't have a dedicated section on foreign aid. Now, you're the expert on this, Dan, and if I may turn the table.
That's why I'm asking.
Yeah. Look, I think we need to use it for a whole bunch of reasons. We need to close the digital divide. I don't want Huawei owning the digital rails of the future. I want to use foreign aid as like a WD-40 lubricant to accelerate nearshoring and friendshoring. I don't want to have to spend a year in my basement again. So I want better early warning systems on this pandemic stuff because I want to know if some of this stuff is coming. I do think it's useful. I do think we should use it at the intersection of making an impact and working towards our interest. I do think some of the ways in which we spend the money, a lot of these decisions were made 20 years ago and have been somewhat on autopilot and probably useful to have a top to bottom review. That's what I call for in my book. Because I'm not sure I eschewed the term a second Cold War, but I think more and more Republicans are using this term. Whether it's great power competition or a second Cold War, I'd say most of our competition's in the global South and most of it's non-military. I'm for a 500-ship Navy. I'm for peace through strength. I'm absolutely for aid to Ukraine, including weapons to Ukraine. And I absolutely think we should send some sort of strong signal to the Iranians that we're not going to tolerate the kind of behavior that they, and we should stand with allies, whether it's Israel or Taiwan or Ukraine. And we need to reestablish deterrence. But I also think we need to use non-forms of military power to kind of continue to expand the circle of freedom and prosperity and plug countries into a US-led system because the Chinese have a separate system on order and are available. And I would argue they're a near-peer soft power competitor. So I think foreign aid and sort of development adjacent kinds of activities, the Exim Bank or the DFC or how we use the MDBs is important to that as well. So yeah, of course, I'm going to say that I pay my mortgage on this stuff, but I think it's important. And I think my argument is most of our second Cold War is going to play out in the global South and most of our competition is non-military. So what's our non-military strategy in the global South? So I recognize it's a leading question, Matt, and it's a little unfair. You know, I know you don't cover it in detail in the book. So yes, it's fair to ask me and you'll get an opinionated response from me because I think a lot about it. But yes, absolutely.
Well, opinionated and informed. So we'll add that chapter to the second edition of the book.
In the next edition of the book, exactly. Okay, let me talk about the global South because I mentioned it in my comment before. Okay, so Dan or Matt, you can take this as our last question. So here's my theory. My theory is, this second Cold War is not playing out in China, though we need to support dissidents in China. We need to support religious minorities in China. This war is not going to play out in Russia, though I would argue we need to support democratic actors and dissidents in Russia. And we need to reach the Russian people. This is also not going to play out in the States. This is going to play out in Africa, Latin America, Southeast Asia, the Pacific Islands, Central Asia, the post-Soviet space, if I can describe it that way. So a shorthand for that is the global South. Okay, so if I said global, I think you're going to see a lot of attention. The Atlantic Council, which you guys are members of, are going to have an excellent conference on this later. This is being recorded in February. By the time this is released, it'll have happened. I think it's great that the Atlantic Council is having a conference on the global South. We will have something the first 10 days of March, an event with global South ambassadors asking the question, how can the United States be a better partner And the silent part is in this age of great power competition and China being a real soft power competitor. So if I said to eat, let me ask you both, if I said global South, if I say Africa, Latin America, Pacific Island, Central Asia, pick a region. So not Iran, not Ukraine, not Taiwan. If I said everywhere else and I said global South in your book, how should we think about that? Because that's how I would argue that most of this competition is going to play out in these other places that I've just described. I'd be curious what your guys' reaction is to that.
So let me start. So in your excellent book, Dan Randi, The American Imperative, you address this, and I agree with your subtitle, Reclaiming U.S. Global Leadership Through Soft Power. It will be through soft power. It will not be through military power, and it will not be through economic power in the old acceptation of the term. So let me elaborate on this. First of all, I think that the second invasion of Ukraine by Russia created a defining moment in which the countries of the world crystallized themselves, sort of self-selected, into three camps. The free world, which includes democracies, whether in Europe, in North America, or in Asia, a few in Africa and Latin America. The new axis of evil, the countries that are supporting Russia, whether economically, militarily, certainly diplomatically. And then a third group that some call Global South. I happen to prefer the term the new non-aligned movement. Other people call them swing countries, which I don't like. Recently in a European podcast, I heard another term, which is also very interesting, transactional countries. So transactional countries or global South countries are not taking a clear position on the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And it is an extraordinarily consequential act because they're basically saying one of the fundamental principles of the Charter of the United Nations does not matter to us. And we are going to be transactional. We are going to continue to do business with China, with Russia, despite the fact that we recognize that they are aggressors and they're doing things that endanger the global stability. The question then becomes, how does the United States deal with these countries? Clearly not militarily. It used to be that the go-to tools used to be economic grants, give them money, give them foreign aid, and preferential access to the U.S. market. So there were economic incentives to these countries. What we saw in the Trump administration and continued in the Biden administration is a departure from these types of tools. There is no willingness on either the Republican or the Democrat side to increase foreign aid in terms of grants and to increase preferential treatment to the U.S. market. So then the question is, what do we have to offer? And what we have to offer is the concept that countries that choose an enabling environment for economic development and societal development in general, they will find a partner in the United States where the U.S. private sector will get involved in these countries and will help them in their growth, not the government, but the private sector. But these countries would have to take the first step themselves and create an enabling environment, fight corruption, have predictable rule of law to settle commercial disputes, and other steps of this sort. So I think that you were right with the soft power as an important tool, and the United States can be a partner for these countries.
Well, look, I want to remind people, this is a really interesting book. I would encourage people to go out and read We Win, They Lose, Republican Foreign Policy in the New Cold War by Matthew Kronig and Dan Negrea. Congratulations, guys. This is a great accomplishment. It's an important contribution. Go out and read it. My intention will be to hope release this podcast around the time of your book launch. So I hope a lot of people go out and read it. Is there a website for the book?
We are working on one.
Okay. You can go on Amazon and pre-order it now. We Win, They Lose. Okay, go out on Amazon and pre-order it. We Win, They Lose. It's an important book. Congratulations, guys.
Very grateful, Dan Randi. Very, very grateful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Dan.
If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our larger suite of CSIS podcasts. From Into Africa, The Asia Chessboard, China Power, AIDS 2020, The Trade Guys, Smart Women, Smart Power, and more. You can listen to them all on major streaming platforms like iTunes and Spotify. Visit csis.org/podcasts to see our full catalog.